From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. North Korea's state-run KCNA news agency Wednesday referred to Tuesday's Singapore summit between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump as epoch-making, opening the door to what it called a radical switchover in hostile North Korea-U.S. relations. It also said both leaders agreed to the principle of step-by-step and simultaneous action in achieving peace. Ken Gause, Director of International Affairs at CNA, said Mr. Trump has adopted a bold but risky strategy that has upended 70 years of the status quo, including a willingness to halt joint war exercises with South Korea, a constant irritant to the North.
70 years, the status quo has guaranteed peace on the peninsula, security, but it has not solved the problem of North Korea. President Trump has adopted a new strategy which basically throws the status quo out the window. It's what I call the go big or go home strategy.
Ken Gause said Mr. Trump is offering incentives to entice Pyongyang to engage and respond in kind. The South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham had a warning for the North.
If there's a cheating North Korea in the future, if there's a promise and not deliver North Korea, then we're probably going to have a war. From President Trump's point of view, he has put his entire presidency on the line here.
KCNA made no mention of the country abandoning its nuclear program, but also indicated Mr. Trump has been invited and accepted an invitation to visit the North. The UN aid chief Tuesday raised alarm over a worsening food crisis in Africa's Sahel region, with malnutrition rates skyrocketing to the worst level since 2012. Mark Lowcock said 6 million people are struggling to feed themselves in the region. This is VOA News. Greece and Macedonia reached a historic settlement Tuesday to their decades-old dispute over the name Macedonia, shared both by the former Yugoslav Republic and the northern region of Greece. Pending the outcome of parliamentary approvals in both countries and a referendum in Macedonia, the Balkans country will herefore be known as the Republic of North Macedonia. The head of the World Health Organization said it's too early to declare victory over Ebola in the latest outbreak in Northwest Democratic Republic of Congo. But Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he's encouraged by the progress being made.
When you compare that to my visits a month ago, as soon as the outbreak was declared, and now there are major developments or really good progress.
He said, "We are still at war and we need to continue to strengthen our surveillance." Despite the DRC Health Ministry's report of a new case of the deadly virus, the WHO credits swift deployment of an experimental Ebola vaccine to containing the outbreak. In Afghanistan, a district governor was killed in northern Faryab province by Taliban fighters despite a temporary ceasefire announced by the government. In South Ghazni province, the Taliban killed 5 security force personnel at a checkpoint near the district governor's home compound. More than 24, including the district governor there, were wounded. Israeli security forces Tuesday began evicting Jewish settlers from several homes which Israel's highest court ruled were built illegally on privately owned Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank. The 15 homes are to be demolished over the next few days despite protests of civil disobedience. Telecom giant AT&T Tuesday won court backing to buy Time Warner for $85 billion, despite efforts to block the deal by the Trump administration. Daniel Petroselli is AT&T's lead lawyer.
We are gratified with the court's decision to categorically reject the government's bid to block this historic merger.
The deal, which could close as early as this week, would be the fourth largest ever in the global telecom media entertainment industry. In professional golf, the U.S. Open Golf Tournament gets underway Thursday. Former number one Tiger Woods said Tuesday he's looking forward to return to the U.S. Open competition in Southampton, New York.
To have won it, you know, 9 times is pretty special. So I'm looking forward to playing this week. I've really missed playing U.S. Opens, and this will be another fun test.
The 42-year-old Woods said life is better now following his arrest last year at the wheel of his car in Florida with several drugs in his system. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi, and today is Wednesday, June the 13th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of Congo says that he will not seek a third mandate in the country's upcoming elections. And the International Labour Organization says well over a million minors are trapped in a system where they are forced to work.
Children's mental development is retarded. It means their physical development is retarded and their psychosocial skills are not well developed because instead of being at play like other children, they will be very hard at work and normally dangerous work.
That is Dr. Joni Musabayana from the International Labour Organization. And in Africa, access to new communication technologies like WhatsApp provides endless opportunities for people to disseminate information, but also disinformation to those in and outside of their social circles.
So I think with fake news, there's a couple ways. I think the number one, it's the hardest way to track, but it's the most pervasive and the most powerful right now, and that's WhatsApp.
That is Mark Kaigwa from Kenya's digital strategy consultancy firm, Nendo. His organization developed Africa's first quiz dedicated to fake news. Those stories and more are coming up right here on The Voice of America. A recent study by The Atlantic says that falsehoods on social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook always beat out the truth and penetrates further, faster, and deeper into the social network than accurate information. The phenomenon of fake news is as pervasive in Africa as it is in Western countries. On the continent, access to new communication technologies like WhatsApp, Facebook, and Twitter provides endless opportunities for people to disseminate information, but also disinformation. This is mainly to those in and outside of their social circles. And this is having a significant effect on communities around the continent in how they understand what is real or not real news. But how can you tell if a story is fake or real? Mark Kaigwa of Nendo, a digital consultancy firm based in Nairobi, joins me in studio this morning to talk to us about a new quiz that was developed by his company in collaboration with other organizations in Kenya and other parts of Africa. Stop, Reflect, Verify is Africa's first quiz dedicated to fake news. So Mark, welcome. Tell us about this quiz. And as a person working in the information space, would I be able to ace this quiz?
Yeah, so the quiz is there. First of all, I think we were just talking off air. You're not supposed to get a perfect score. So I think there's sometimes this pressure of like, I want to ace the quiz. The quiz is there for your learning. So don't rush through it. Take your time. And the idea is that when you visit stopreflectverify.com, what you're getting access to is you're getting access to us, the team and I, an opportunity to see our thinking around WhatsApp, around screenshots, around the way that Africans and African diaspora use social media. There's a lot of fake news purveyors who are right. taking advantage.
Right.
And so this website's there for that.
Let's talk about some of the purveyors. What are some of the ways in which fake news is being amplified on the continent right now?
So I think with fake news, there's a couple ways. I think the number one, it's the hardest way to track, but it's the most pervasive and the most powerful right now, and that's WhatsApp. So what people are doing is that they know that WhatsApp has, in the case of Kenya, 12 million users. Facebook is second in quotes with 8 million, and Twitter has just 1 million. So what people are doing is they take screenshots a lot. And those screenshots, what people don't realize is they can be falsified. Mm. And so what we find is that if you're in Africa today, WhatsApp will be the key battleground. So we're challenging people saying, hey, why don't we use WhatsApp status and have an official appointed line belonging to an organization? And look, we're not going to make any promises that you'll respond to WhatsApp messages, but we're telling you, look at our status.
Right.
If we don't share it there, it didn't happen. And that's some of the ways we're moving from a conversation on, hey, here's the fake news example, to here's a solution.
Right.
I think Facebook groups as well. these closed communities where I'm in this ethnic group, we have our Facebook group, I'm in this county, we have that Facebook group, I'm in this party. Mm. And those are also...
I mean, this social group or correct. Economic group or political group.
That's right.
That, I have this message and mm-hmm. we kind of have these echo chambers mm-hmm. that kind of amplify whatever ideologies that we have. How can people spot fake news?
I think there's a couple of ways to spot it. I think fake news starts off with taking your over-reliance on a phrase known as sent as received, right? So you have the opportunity to receive a lot of forwards in your groups, chain mail, yeah. all
and,
sorts
and,
of forwards,
we
right?
Know we are all in these WhatsApp groups, like 20 of them. Now, many people do not have that digital literacy to spot some of those things that you talked about, the dead, the URL, and they don't even know. Many people don't even know what a URL is. Who is more prone to fake news, to falling for these things? Is it people who are literate and have access to these technologies, or the people who are, I guess, poorer and are illiterate and have less access to information on these gadgets and maybe a little excited when they have, you know, this information on coming to them?
Sure. I'd say the people who have the biggest consequences or stakes is people in peri-urban and rural areas who will hear it second or third hand and have a higher believability factor in WhatsApp and some of the social circles. Because the difference with something like WhatsApp over Facebook or anywhere else is my friends and family sent this to me. So the trust factor is higher, mm-hmm. right? But what I will say is it's less about age or demographics or location. It's actually more about behavior. So if you're somebody who has made up your mind about a certain political candidate, political situation, what fake news players are actually playing into is your confirmation bias. I knew he was like that, see? Right? I knew that happened. Don't, you know, right, see? Right. Or sometimes they're just generally trolling people. Right. So it's the middle of a crisis and they're sharing fake photos of people who are missing, right? Because they want the retweets, mm-hmm. because they want the likes, right? And sometimes, I mean, there's examples where Africa Check, who are a great organization, africacheck.org, they will actually debunk something underneath the person's tweet, and the person doesn't bring it down because they're like, but look at all the retweets I got. Right. Forget about it. I'm ignoring it. They're like, but this is...
They'd rather get the retweets and amplify a fake story.
That's right.
I guess finally, Mark, yesterday on Daybreak Africa, I covered a story about Tanzania, the government of Tanzania, that is asking online bloggers and websites and YouTubers and everybody else who's kind of producing content to either register and pay a certain sum of money or pull it down. And obviously, in many ways, that is infringing on free speech. On the other hand, the government is saying that we're doing it as a way to protect our citizens from this fake news. Mm. How does a government do it without necessarily infringing on the rights of people to share information?
I think this is it's a tough one. And the reason it's a tough one is because at the end of the day, we have to look to the Constitution. You know, some people say that, oh, well, that Constitution doesn't know about fake news, doesn't know about the internet, but it has certain freedoms. So whether it's the Tanzanian Constitution or the Kenyan one, at the end of the day, the toughest part to bring them back to legally is what does the Constitution say about our freedom to express ourselves and our freedom of information?
Thank you very much, Mark. That was Mark Kaigwa from the Africa Digital Strategy Consultancy Firm, Nendo. He's based in Nairobi, Kenya. He was joining us this morning in our studios here at the Voice of America. June 12th is World Day Against Child Labor. The International Labor Organization says well over a million minors are trapped in a system where they are forced to work. Some of them find themselves in hazardous conditions where they have to operate machinery or work underground. Researchers say that this not only affects their physical development, but also has a long-standing psychological effect as well. From Johannesburg, South Africa, Nadia Sami has more on this story.
Over 150 million children around the world are involved in child labor. That's according to the International Labor Organization. The minors are aged between 5 and 17. Dr. Joni Musabayana from the ILO says the effects on such children could linger for a lifetime.
Children's mental development is retarded. It means their physical development is retarded and their psychosocial skills are not well developed, because instead of being at play like other children, they will be very hard at work and normally dangerous work, which is also injurious to their safety and health. These components constitute what we call hazardous child labour.
The biggest proportion of child labourers are found in Africa, Asia and the Pacific region. Dr. Musabayana says governments must do more to crack down on those who violate children's rights and rob them of important developmental years.
Of the 152 million, Africa accounts for almost half at 72 million. Asia accounts for 62 million. The Arab states are on 1.5 million. And Europe and Central Asia, they are on 5.5 million. Now, these figures, worrying as they are because of their high numbers, the trend globally has been declining. Unfortunately, on the African continent, that trend has been increasing. So we have to quickly zero in on the African continent and see what is happening there.
Poverty and a lack of security are among the main drivers of child labor.
The main sub-regions of concern is the Central Africa region. That is where you have DRC, Equatorial Guinea, Chad. And the biggest driver there is insecurity and what we call fragility, which means that the safety of the communities and of the country are threatened, particularly by rebel movements, particularly by uprisings against sitting authorities. When you now look particularly at Southern Africa, you see that the biggest driver there is actually young people, young children trying to complement family household income. And that is therefore a phenomenon driven largely by poverty.
The organization says children often end up in these difficult situations because the communities they're in have been decimated and adults fight for survival means childcare is overlooked. It says the key is to stabilize fragile communities. This year's World Day Against Child Labour is being used to accelerate efforts to improve the safety of young workers and ultimately eradicate all forms of child labour by 2025. This is in accordance with United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
UN agencies are warning of major tragedies if countries refuse to accept refugees and migrants rescued at sea. This warning comes after Italy and Malta refused permission for the boat Aquarius to dock after it had rescued 629 migrants on Sunday off of the coast of Libya. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Spain finally came to the rescue and offered its port of Valencia as a safe harbor for the boatload of migrants. But it will take several days before the Aquarius reaches port with its cargo of frightened and ill people. The UN Refugee Agency rejects suggestions that boats run by private organizations should stop rescuing people, claiming saving their lives acts as an incentive for migrants to make this perilous journey in search of a better life in Europe. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mehecic says rescue at sea is a long tradition, one that is upheld by international maritime conventions. He tells VOA there is no merit to the argument that people in distress will be dissuaded from crossing the sea in a flimsy boat if they knew they would not be rescued. He notes there were no search and rescue operations in the Aegean in 2014 when many boats were arriving in Greece from Syria at the height of the Middle East crisis and from West Africa because of the Boko Haram insurgency.
From the empirical evidence, the boats have been arriving whether there were or were not rescue operations in the Mediterranean or in Eastern Mediterranean or in Central Mediterranean. Even at the time when some of the search and rescue operations were suspended, the boats were still leaving the shores of Africa.
The International Organization for Migration urges the European Union to revise the so-called Dublin regulations, which usually holds the state through which an asylum seeker first enters the EU, responsible for vetting the claim and taking in the asylum seeker. The IOM and other humanitarian organizations argue it is not fair that a country such as Italy, which tends to be the first port of call, be responsible responsible for the thousands of asylum seekers and migrants that land on its shores. They say other EU countries should share this burden. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And yesterday was the International Day for Albinism. It is a day dedicated to celebrate the success and challenges that people with albinism go through in life. And in Uganda, just like other parts of the world, albinos say they are discriminated against. And from Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Ruakarinji files this report.
According to the United Nations, there are about 10,000 people living with albinism in Uganda. Olive Namtebi, the executive director of Albinism Umbrella in Uganda, says albinos in the country are misunderstood socially and medically. Namtebi, herself an albino, says life was quite challenging when she was still a little girl. Her peers used to undermine her and usually would not want her to play with them. She says she lived a traumatized life.
I was in a day school to begin with. It was a challenge. I used to move with a crowd at the back. People shouting Muzungu, Namagwe. Now you can imagine a seven-year-old, you know that age, and you have this crowd following you, Muzungu, Muzungu. And that created some kind of, can I say, you want to be an introvert because you want to carve in, you know, in the public. Right now, actually, I hate crowds, I think, because of that. Because now for me, a crowd will remind me of, you know, those childhood times.
Albinism is a rare group of genetic disorders that cause the skin, hair or eyes to have little or no color. The physical appearance of persons with albinism is often the object of erroneous beliefs and myths, influenced by superstition, which foster their marginalization and social exclusion. In fact, Namtebi says the effects of albinism started the day she was born.
I'm told at my birth, my father had, I don't know if he saw me, but heard that the child you have is an albino, and just sent message, said, no, me, I cannot father children with albinism. So my mom was left to care for me alone. It's interesting how just one auntie from my paternal side actually said, no, that child is ours, and the family blacklisted her, as in you can't be the one on the side of the woman, it is the woman's fault.
Slivia Mwebwa Ntambi is the head of Equal Opportunities Commission in Uganda that works to eliminate any forms of discrimination. She says, unfortunately, such cases are all very common in Uganda.
Many people with albinism live in fear of being attacked, being sacrificed, being abducted, or killed. And it is believed that their graves are usually exhumed because of sacrifices that ought to be made, since people believe that they can be made rich.
The United Nations says these beliefs and myths are centuries old and are present in cultural attitudes and practices around the world. The theme of this year's celebration is Shining Our Light to the World, which highlights the achievements of albinos in communities. And there are many cases of people like Namtebi, albinos that have performed even extraordinarily better than others. In neighboring Kenya, last year, a 14-year-old girl, Godlin Kakuya, with albinism, topped Kenya's national primary school exams after scoring an A in all subjects. Namtebi herself has beaten odds and is one example of a successful person. She has a bachelor's degree in accounting, has traveled in various countries and continents, and drives her own car.
When I got my first job, then my esteem was really built. I felt, let me really overperform. Let me do exactly, or even no, above what I'm expected to do, so I can ably go to any other place. And that opened many doors. I would feel, because like I've told you, I started with a microfinance, I went to an NGO, I went to Caltex, now Chevron, then I went to the bank. You would see all those jobs were on merit.
There's no cure for albinism, but there is some treatment that can relieve symptoms and prevent sun damage. Namtebi says the only way to stamp out the discrimination against people living with albinism is to sensitize the population that albinos are just like any other human beings. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Gambia's former dictator Yahya Jammeh, exiled in Equatorial Guinea, has rescinded his decision to dissolve the leadership of his former ruling Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction Party, APRC. Mr. Jammeh had earlier fired the APRC leadership and replaced them with a new executive headed by a former army general and one-time Gambia's interior minister, Mamadou Aliou Ba. Reporter Pat Nderimbai has more on Jammeh's decision that has created confusion within the APRC party.
The former ruling APRC party has been divided amid confusion caused by the exiled Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh. Accusations and counter-accusations of leadership struggle among officials of the party continue to dominate the news cycle in Banjul. This followed a recent phone call Jammeh made to the APRC leadership, dissolving the entire executive of the party. He appointed a former army general to lead the party. Within 24 hours, Jammeh rescinded his decision. Mr. Jammeh, who is living in exile in Equatorial Guinea, is apparently not happy with the party's performance in the just-concluded council and mayoral elections. The one-time dominant APRC party couldn't win any seat in the mayoral elections. Fabakary Tombonjata is the interim leader of the APRC party.
The changes are necessitated to redress the act of some party members whose behavior posed threat of jeopardizing the harmony and unity of the party. By this mischief, I therefore urge all supporters of the APRC to be aware of the changes and continue to exercise their loyalty and unreserved support to the executive. Meanwhile, all loyalists are hereby informed that the former president and founding father of the party has given his blessings to this new development within the party.
But General Mamadou Aliou Ba insists that he is the new leader of the APRC.
If Jammeh can appoint me in front of the entire APRC executive Friday, look, I don't have any problem with Jammeh, it was gone from Rambo's house, only Tombong and Rambo, when they said, he called them, which I'm not even sure they would whether they called them. Whilst the rest of the members were meeting at the bureau.
Meanwhile, one of the supporters of the opposition APRC party, Omar Touré, has been charged with insulting President Adama Barrow. Touré has been accused of demeaning the reputation of the president in a WhatsApp message circulated on the internet. Ousmane Diatta is an official of the APRC party.
The bail bond was set at $500,000 in cash and a compound worth $500,000 with two Gambian ID cards. That's $1 million, just for saying something against President Barrow.
Jata says if President Donald Trump can be criticized and called names, he sees no reason why President Barrow should be spared. But his party leader, Fabakary Tombonjata, warns against the abuse of social media.
All APRC supporters in the Gambia and the diaspora using the social media of any form, ranging from Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, etc., are herein advised to be ethical and desist from all forms of sharing information that are detrimental to the integrity of the party, making derogatory language or insults, incitement of violence, spreading false information amongst others. This will no longer be tolerated.
Omar Touré is yet to post a bond to secure his release from police custody. The leadership of the APRC have called for his immediate release. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June the 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Mvonganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good morning, Africa.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you. I'm the king of the country, and I love the way I First, a 30-minute playlist of the continent's best music. Then, a live studio interview and music performance by Leni Stern Trio. Think award-winning female electric guitar player falls in love with West African griot music. So lots of love coming to you this weekend. Don't miss it on Music Time in Africa, Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Yeah!